Hello again. Welcome to the Three Worlds podcast. This is episode 6 of the third series. And today I'm going to talk about things Tibetan. I've kind of mentioned and said little bits about Tibet for a while, so I thought it would be kind of nice to actually do a dedicated podcast on it. So this one is going to feature and look at both Tibetan Tantra and Tibetan shamanism, and the kind of origins and the relationships and some of the practices and all of that kind of stuff. So off we go. Now, Tibet has always been seen as a mysterious place in the West and has been the subject of lots of popular misconceptions and lots of popular fiction as well. You know, from Lost Horizons with Shangri-La to all sorts of bits and pieces. It was a closed country for a long time, and if you were a non-Tibetan that tried to travel across it, you often got short shrift. It was also at one point a very warlike country, incredibly warlike. You know, it captured large parts of India. It attacked China. It took over all sorts of different places. It was known for its warlikeness. And then gradually from the 8th century onwards, it kind of stopped being like that. It was still very warlike within Tibet. Tibet was a place of banditry and violence, but it stopped trying to dominate other countries. And that was because of the rise of Buddhism, which came to Tibet in the 8th century. So Tibet, before Buddhism, was part of a great big country called Shangshung. Shangshung was all of modern Tibet, parts of Nepal, and it went further north of Tibet. Now, where Tibet is, it went across the Taklamakan Desert, all of the kind of areas of the Silk Road, which are now part of Xinjiang in western China. And it kind of went up to the borders of Mongolia, and then westwards it went to the top part and the sort of northern parts of Afghanistan and kind of covered Pakistan and places like that. I mean, it was a very, very big country. And the spirituality of the country was Bon. Now, Bon is the pre-Buddhist Tibetan kind of, I'm loath to say religion, but spirituality. It's the understanding about creation that was in Tibet before Buddhism arrived. It's still there. There are still Bon teachers, but Bon now is very different to Bon then. Bon then was very much a shamanic tradition, and it had a lot to do and a lot in common with the traditions of shamanism that were found all over Central Asia and up into Mongolia. It was incredibly similar, and it had the same sort of worldview. Then the Buddhists came into Tibet, or Tibet kind of established Buddhism and developed it, and Bon changed. Bon kind of got persecuted quite a lot over the centuries by Buddhism, and so it kind of camouflaged itself, and it kind of became squeaky clean and became kind of new Bon. It's not at all the same as old Bon. And new Bon is kind of more Buddhist than the Buddhists in many ways, although it does still contain some of the old original shamanic teachings. But they're very affected now by Buddhism. They're very overlaid by it. Same kind of thing happened with Islam in Central Asia. You get Islamic shamans, and they have traces of the old pre-Islamic traditions, but they are also now very Islamic. And the same happens everywhere. I mean, you only got to look at some of the Christian traditions in the West that have elements of paganism in. It's what humans do. But it very much happened in Tibet with the Bon traditions. So you had this great kind of empire, Shangshung, and Bon was the kind of the orthodox religion, in inverted commas, of the civilization, and it was divided up into different areas. sort of like regions, and the ruler of the region that is now pretty much Tibet wanted to establish his own power base. And so he declared himself a king, and the problem that he had was all of his ministers, all of the people that were kind of around, all of the officials, all of the tax collectors, all of the everybody that was the establishment were all Bon, and therefore they were the old guard. So he decided that the easiest way for him to establish a power base was to call in a new religion and kind of kick out all of the Bon people of the old school and get in a new lot, which is why Buddhism came to Tibet in the 8th century. Now, this is a really kind of quick, simple overview, and the barest facts. And, you know, this podcast is not a podcast about the history of Central Asia, but I just thought it was important to give at least a little bit of background as to sort of the origins of Tibet, because it does play a part in how the sacred traditions of Tibet came about. So you have this deeply magical, in the fact that it used magic, shamanic, animistic culture, and it wanted to become kind of Buddhist, or the king, Trisong Detsen, wanted it to become Buddhist so that he could establish his power base. And so he called in different Buddhist teachers from the surrounding areas, and probably the most important of these was a teacher from the northern part of Pakistan, Swat Valley. Generally it's considered that he came from the Swat Valley, and his name was Padmasambhava. He's also known as Guru Rinpoche. Guru is teacher, and Rinpoche is precious. So it's precious teacher, Guru Rinpoche. Now, Padmasambhava was not a Buddhist in the sort that just sort of sits and goes om and meditates. Very different to the original Buddha. He was a tantric magician, and he practiced a form of Buddhism which is magical Buddhism, which is Tantra, tantric Buddhism, Vajrayana. So he came to Tibet, and because in a way his Buddhism was kind of closely akin in some respects to the magical traditions of his homeland and also to the kind of magical traditions of Shangxiong, he combined his magic with the original shamanic parts that were there in Shangxiong. Now, the story is that he kind of went all over Tibet and oath-bound made all of the spirits of Tibet swear an oath that they would sort of swap allegiance and become Buddhist and look after the Buddhist teachings and the practitioners. So look, we've zoomed over a massive subject and I've left lots and lots of things out. And for some of you, it will be annoying because I haven't said enough. And for some of you, they'll be saying, oh God, he's gone on about Buddhist history for 8 minutes. So sorry for those of you who are bored, and sorry for those of you who don't think I've said enough. But now let's get on to something a little bit more meaty and actually talk about the business end. Okay, so let's talk about the practices, the sort of traditions, the lineages, for want of a better way of putting it, within Tibet. There are the Buddhist ones. Now, the Buddhist ones are divided up into the monastic and the non-monastic. And they practice a form of magic which is very influenced by Buddhism, but it's tantra, it's tantric magic. And then there are the non-Buddhist older forms, which include Bon, but also include the sort of village shamans, and also include all of the folk magic. Now, there's huge amounts of sorcery in Tibet. It's a country where there are many, many, many different forms of sorcery, and there used to be, and there probably still are, vast amounts of what could be called black magic practiced. We have a very rosy view of Tibet in the West because of the Dalai Lama, who's done a wonderful PR job. And nothing against the Dalai Lama, but, you know, he really has. And I once heard a Tibetologist, that's a person who studies Tibetan things, talking about it. And he described there being two sorts of Buddhism. And in a way, this applies to two sorts of Tibet. There's Californian Buddhism, which is the lovely kind of Western stuff that we have, where we have the smiley Dalai Lama being all nice and compassionate. And then there's the other sort, which he described as spooky Buddhism. And spooky Buddhism is actually the kind of the more real stuff. There isn't, it's not, that's not to say that there wasn't some of the compassionate Californian Buddhism too, but Californian Buddhism is the Buddhism and the Tibet stuff that has been sold to the West. But the bulk of it is spooky Buddhism. And that's why Tibetan magic and Tibetan sorcery and Tibetan practices are quite kind of, well, you could call them dark in some respects. That's not to say they are necessarily uncompassionate. Some of them are very compassionate, but they're still dark. Some people say that this is because of the altitude and the wildness of the landscape. And maybe it is. I don't know. But certainly there seems to be a plethora of kind of hostile spirits and wrathful, aggressive spirits, wild spirits, spirits that are untamed, even with the stomping about the countryside of Padmasambhava, making them all oath-bound. There is still spirit quality that is untamed, unbound, red in tooth and claw. So let's talk about Tibetan shamanism. Tibetan shamans, they have different names depending on kind of who they are and also where they are in the country and also in the surrounding countries like Ladakh and Bhutan and places like that. But the commonest name for them is a Lapa. A Lapa or a Lamo. Now, La means spirit or God. And Pa means man or Mo means woman. So it's a spirit man or a spirit woman. Lapa Lamo. And they go into trance. They are proper shamans in the way that shamanism can be defined as somebody who goes into trance and goes off to the spirits. But generally they have the spirits come into them. They get possessed by the spirits. Now, very often, I'm talking kind of pre-conquest, because it's all changed now a little bit because of the Chinese. So it's still there, but these traditions are kind of fading. I've got to say that they are sadly fading. But so I guess I'm talking about something that was maybe 50 years ago or whatever, and it's still there, but it's not there so much. How it used to be was that the villages would all have people who were Lapas. Now, the Lapas are, some of them are Buddhist and some of them are not Buddhist and some of them are semi-Buddhist. A lot of the Lapas will say that Padmasambhava was the original shaman of their lineage. And yet what they do doesn't really completely fit into Buddhism, so it's a bit mixed up. But basically they work with local spirits, which are generally considered to be local protector spirits. And these are kind of nature spirits. They're not ancestors. Lots of Mongolian shamans and other shamans around the world will work with ancestral figures. These are not ancestral figures. They tend to be figures, spirits from the landscape. So you will get the Lapas being taken over by mountain spirits. Very often they're mountain spirits, or they're spirits that at least manifest as mountains and live in mountains. And some of them will be big, big spirits. They're kind of like national spirits. And if a Lapa is taken over by a big spirit, then they might kind of get to be within a monastic situation. So you have something like the Tibetan State Oracle. That's a perfect example. The Tibetan State Oracle really is a Lapa, but they've been monasticized, I guess. Is that a word? Taken into the Buddhist kind of hierarchy and made official. The Tibetan State Oracle is taken over by a mountain spirit called Piha. And through the oracle, Piha will give messages to the Dalai Lama and the government. There are other big state oracles. Generally, a monastery would have an oracle, and the Tibetan State Oracle is kind of the pinnacle of the lot. But all of the little villages had Lapas. They all kind of do the same stuff. very much work in the same way. So a LARPA will have ceremonies where they get taken over by the spirits, and what they describe as their own soul goes out, and the soul, the spirit of the wrathful being that comes in, and they are generally wrathful too, they're kind of fairly fierce, will come in and sort of act through the LARPA's body. And the way they do that is different to the way that some other shamans do it. What they tend to do is they use milong, mirrors. The LARPA will set up mirrors on their altar, and the mirrors kind of become portals, doorways to the spirit world. And they describe them as being a little bit like assembly halls. The spirits and all the retinue of the spirits. So, it's like there will be a mountain spirit that will take over the LARPA, but the mountain spirit will bring all of his friends too. So he has a retinue of other spirits that come. So the retinue of the spirits gather in the mirror, and the LARPA will kind of put on their clothes and sing the songs and do all the bits and pieces that they do in order to go into trance. And then the mountain spirit will come into the LARPA, and the LARPA spirit will go into the mirror, and they swap places. And the shamans don't tend to journey in the classical way that we think of journeying, especially with core shamanism. The LARPA spirits, they kind of see the retinue beings. They kind of go out and do all the reconnoitering. And I always imagine it a little bit like drones with cameras on. So the LARPA kind of sees what's happening because the retinue spirits are going out and they're kind of seeing through the retinue spirits' eyes. It's kind of quite different to the way that we think of shamanism generally. And like I say, it's very different to the core shamanism that many of us do. So these shamans will do their trance work, just like shamans do, and also just like shamans do, they will do work that is not done while they're in trance. They will do divinations for people. They will do healings for people. They do forms of soul retrieval, which are very different to anything that you might learn about in core shamanism. And maybe I'll talk about Tibetan soul retrieval another time, because it's quite complex and not for now. They are also very often sanctioned by monasteries. A LARPA will be trained by other LARPAs, but then they will have to go and kind of get a sanction from the monastery that the spirits that come into them are kind of okay spirits. This will be partially done through tests and partially done through divination methods that the monks also kind of make the shaman go through. So when a shaman sees like a kid in the area having some form of possession, they will perhaps think whether they're going to be a LARPA or not. Although sometimes it also runs in families. It's not a hard, fast thing. But if somebody is behaving in a difficult way and having difficulties, a LARPA will get called in and they will kind of diagnose the person and do an exorcism if there is a spirit bothering them that is just an ordinary spirit. But if they're not sure, or if they definitely think that it's a LARPA spirit that's coming in, then they will first of all do tests to the person that is sick to see if the spirit is a LARPA spirit or whether it's just a possessing spirit out for mischief. And if it's a LARPA spirit, then they will train them and teach them, and they will generally call in the monastery at that point too to also ascertain. So the LARPA kind of grows up sanctioned by the monastery, may go and have times of retreat in the monastery, and may get some Buddhist teachings as well. So you see, it is this sort of hybrid. A lot of the Buddhist traditions in Tibet, a lot of the different Buddhist schools, are quite down on shamanism. A little bit like the Christians were down on kind of pagans and witches when they took over in Europe. So I think probably they tend to keep the shamans on a fairly tight leash. The same thing happened in Mongolia when Buddhism was established in Mongolia, which was later, sort of 14th century, 15th century. And a lot of the shamans were very persecuted by the Buddhists, and shamanic objects were kind of gathered together and destroyed, and shamans were actually killed. And the same thing undoubtedly happened in Tibet as well. So it is something that is there still, but it is kind of fairly tightly controlled. What happened in Tibet was that when Padmasambhava came in, he originally fused a lot of the tantric Tibetan or the tantric Buddhist practices with the pre-existing shamanic ones and formed a school of Buddhism which are called the Nyingma, which means the ancient school. And that's the oldest school in Tibet. And then gradually, a little bit like kind of Protestantism grew out of Catholicism in the West, reform schools came in. And they kind of cleaned it up and became kind of a bit more in their head and took out some of the magic. The Dalai Lama is the head of a reform school. You can generally tell the reform schools because they wear yellow hats, and they're often kind of known as the yellow hat schools, whereas the original school, the Nyingma, and there's a couple of other schools too that kind of fit in with that kind of group, they wear red hats, and they're called the red hat schools. Those terms, yellow and red hat, tend to be more Western things. I don't think Tibetans call them those themselves, but very much in the West, they're known as red hat school and yellow hat school. So the red hat schools are the oldest, and they tend to be the more shamanic, and they tend to be more tolerant, I think is a good way of putting it, of shamanism. The yellow hat schools can be very intolerant, and it was the yellow hat schools, the Galupa schools, that went into Mongolia. So the Mongolian shamans had a bit of a harder ride than the Tibetan shamans in some respects. Just to clarify something, I made a slight mistake. The Dalai Lama is not the head of the Galupa school. He's really a secular figure in some respects. He's kind of to do with the government. And there is another person who's in charge, another Lama who's in charge of the Galupa. And I can't actually remember who he is or what his title is. Dalai Lama is not exactly secular, but he's not the head of the school as such. Now, to add to the confusion slightly, you have your village shamans, but you'll also very often have another form of practitioner in a village, and they will be called a Nagpa. And they can be Tibetan Buddhist, and they can be Tibetan Bon. And sometimes they can be a kind of bit of both. It really is a bit of a muddle at times. They're generally not shamans, but they do the same sort of work, although they do it in slightly different ways. Now, a Nagpa, the word Nag means mantra, and Pa is a man, so it's a mantra man. And there are also Nagma, which are mantra women, although that seems to be a term that is a fairly recent term, because historically it looks like Nagpa was a patrilineal society or a patrilineal kind of occupation, really, because what would happen was that the village Nagpa would educate their son, and the lineage was passed down from father to son and stayed within the village, a bit like a village might have a blacksmith that the trade was passed on. They would have a Nagpa that the trade would be passed on. Now, Nagpas do magic, but they do more tantric magic than shamanic magic. And they do, in a way, similar things. They do healings, they do blessings, they do exorcisms, they control the weather, they work with the crops to help them grow, they protect the village. They will at times defend the village and attack other villages. That certainly would have gone on. It was very much the same roles that a shaman would have, but they kind of do it differently. Now, the spirits that the Nagpas work with are all really Buddhist spirits, and they are, in kind of Buddhism, they are thought of as being either Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. Now, a Bodhisattva is a being that has become a Buddha but has decided that they're not going to leave the world. They're going to stay and help all other sentient beings in the world, getting born again and again and again so they can help beings. And they make a vow called the Bodhisattva Vow, which is that they won't leave the world until all beings are enlightened, and that all beings, in effect, have left the world because they have seen the true nature of reality and are liberated, in inverted commas. So Nagpa's work with these yidams. Now, a yidam is an awareness being. It's a being that may be peaceful, like Chenrezig. Chenrezig is the kind of god, for want of a better word, of compassion. Quite a popular and famous Tibetan being. He has four arms and one head, and he sits in a kind of meditative pose. Or maybe it would be Green Tara. Green Tara, the female Buddha, who is, again, is a peaceful being. Or it could be a form of being which is classed as joyful, and they are Dakinis. Now, Dakinis are enlightened female beings, and they can generally be told apart from all the rest, because if you see statues or paintings of them, they're generally dancing on one leg and the other leg is kind of curled up against their thigh. So they're kind of doing this sort of one-legged hopping dance. That's kind of what it looks like. And they are sort of semi-wrathful. They always have fangs. They remind me of vampires. If you look at their faces, you see that they're showing their fangs. And they're joyful. They're kind of smiling, but the smile isn't altogether reassuring. And many of them are in kind of human form, but some of them are in more kind of zoomorphic form. There's a particular famous one called Simamuka, who is the lion-headed Dakini. Sengi Dongma is her Tibetan name. Simamuka is the Sanskrit name. And lion-headed Dakini is the sort of English name. And then you get wrathful ones, wrathful yidams, who might be Dorji Purba, or who might be Mahakala, or, well, there's lots and lots of them, and they are the truly sort of wrathful ones. They're kind of quite sort of demonic looking. Very often will be swinging weapons around, and, like I say, kind of garland in severed human heads, and wearing flayed skins, tiger skins or elephant skins or human skins, often trampling on corpses, sometimes kind of emerging out of oceans of blood. They look mean, tough dudes and scary dudes, and they are scary dudes, but they're also compassionate. They are the wrathful manifestations of the compassionate Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And so they kind of deliver tough love, but it's not like evil or anything along those lines. They are good guys with attitude. So Nagpa's work with all of those. And I think at this point, it's probably a good time to kind of draw a veil over that, and I'll talk more about Nagpa and tantric traditions next time and talk about some of the ways that they work. So, okay, I'm going to invite you into the Three World Shamanism Facebook group, because we've got the most wonderful film in there in our film library called The Fate of the Lapa, which is a documentary film, a wonderful film, all about the Lapa tradition of Tibet, and it's about a group of Lapa that escaped the Chinese and came into Nepal, and well worth watching. And it's not really available anywhere. You won't find it on YouTube or anywhere else. It's only in our group. And there's also another film in there which is called Oracles and Demons of Ladakh, which is about the oracle tradition, the Lapa tradition of Ladakh, which is the same because Ladakh is part of the greater Tibetan world. So it's very, very much the same tradition. So if you'd like to Join Facebook if you're not a member and come and say hello in our group, and then you can watch these films. And if you want to email me, it's nick@sacredhoop.org. If you'd like to donate to the podcast, please send a PayPal donation to donation@sacredhoop.org. The magazine, sacredhoop.org/offer.html. And the sample copy can be got from sacredhoop.org/sample.html. And the Three Worlds website, where there's all the ritual objects and articles, including some articles about LARPers that you can download and read, all in PDF form. And that is threeworlds.co.uk. I hope you've enjoyed this one. Have fun, be good, bye.